big and friendly.
Elephant.
Wrinkled and gray.
Elephant.
And with her great big feet, better get out of the way of the elephant.
Elephant.
Every sound in the jungle, the elephant hears with their floppy king-sized elephant ears. Got a trunk for a nose as long as a hose.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. A couple of weeks ago, the New York State Court of Appeals ruled on a petition submitted by the Non-Human Rights Project, arguing that non-human animals are legal persons being unlawfully confined, and as such, they're entitled to the remedy of habeas corpus. The specific focus of the petition was Happy, an elephant that has resided at the Bronx Zoo for the last 45 years. Much to the dismay of petitioners and many others, the court decided that Happy is not a person and has no right to be freed from captivity. But are elephants people? Do they have rights? A growing number of human people around the world argue that both animals and nature have rights and must be treated with the same consideration granted to human persons. Not that this is done always and everywhere for humans. That is the topic for today's show. My guest today on Sustainability Now is Professor Matthew Liebman, Associate Professor and Chair of the Justice for Animals Program at the Law School at the University of San Francisco. Before taking up his chair at USF, Professor Liebman was the director of litigation for the Animal Legal Defense Fund, where he litigated animal protection cases, including groundbreaking ones to defend the First Amendment rights of activists and to establish fundamental legal rights for non-human animals. He's co-author with Bruce Wagman of A Worldview of Animal Law, which examines how the legal systems of different countries govern our interactions with animals. Professor Liebman's writing has also appeared in the Animal Law Review, the Journal of Animal Law, the Stanford Environmental Law Journal, and the Animal Legal and Historical Web Center. Professor Liebman, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Why don't we begin with a little bit of background? What is the Justice for Animals program at the University of San Francisco, and what are your responsibilities as program chair?
Well, the Justice for Animals program was created about 2 years ago through an anonymous donation or a donation from an anonymous donor who is an alum of the University of San Francisco, whose life work and mission is the defense and protection of the non-human world. And the donor wanted to endow a position in the law school to foster the study of the protection of animals through the law and the creation of legal rights for animals. And so the University of San Francisco School of Law initiated a search for someone to run that program. And I was fortunate enough to be hired to do that. I had a career for about 12 years as a litigator for a group called the Animal Legal Defense Fund. I was a in the trenches litigator and then the director of litigation for a number of years at ALDF, and then made the transition to run this program at USF, which has the goal of training lawyers, training law students to become advocates for animals through the legal system.
So what do you do as program chair?
Well, my position is it's a tenure track faculty position. So I teach courses in animal law. I teach a course on sort of the doctrinal issues in animal law, and then another seminar, which really digs deep into the theoretical and philosophical issues on animal justice. And then I also teach a course in professional responsibility. We also want to not just sort of have it be, you know, the academic work of teaching and writing scholarship, but also making a difference. The mission of the university is to change the world from here. So we want to also create opportunities for students to have to work on actual cases. So I've maintained a little bit of a legal practice doing animal protection cases. I've recently submitted an amicus brief and major animal rights case about the rights of an elephant named Happy. I'm the lead attorney on a case called Justice versus Virtue, where my client is a horse who is suing for damages. So I am trying to keep a foot in the practice world in addition to the academic world of teaching and writing.
Well, I'd like to get back to those cases a little bit later in our interview. The horse is sort of interesting. So who takes your classes? I mean, what sorts of students and what are their particular interests?
Well, it's a wide range of students. Some of them already have an interest and familiarity with, if not animal law, then at least animal protection issues and animal rights. Others are just sort of curious, and it might be that the course is offered at a time that fits in their schedule and animal law sounded interesting. And so they've, I'd say majority of the students don't have a pre-existing interest in animals. They just sort of thought the class sounded interesting, and hopefully they end up learning a lot, both kind of substantively about what the law is for animals, and maybe think a little more deeply about the really complex moral and ethical issues that the courses raise.
Well, how did you get interested in animal rights?
Well, I think I've just always had sort of a, you know, affinity for animals, compassionate spot for animals. But I really can trace it to when I was about 15. I got a bird, a little conure, a green conure, which is a small parrot named Chaplin. And we didn't have a lot of pets growing up. We had, you know, a few hamsters here and there. But this was really my first pet. So I went to a pet store looking to get a pet and ended up going home with bringing Chaplin home with me. Knowing what I know now about the pet trade and the bird trade in particular, not something I would do or encourage anyone else to do, but I didn't know better at the time. And Chaplin ended up becoming really the first companion animal that I had as an adolescent, and really bonded with him. And it was a moment where I really realized that animals were someone and not something. Just kind of the amount of time that I spent with him learning his quirks and his personality and his individuality, I think really drove home to me the subjecthood of animals, for lack of a better way of phrasing it. And that really got me thinking about a lot of the kind of bigger issues in animal protection. I remember they told me when I brought Chaplin home that in addition to his pellets and seeds and the fruit that I prepared him, he could also eat whatever I was eating. And so if I was eating chicken, he could have some chicken. If I was eating some hamburger, he could have some of the hamburger. And I went to do that, and something about it seemed very strange to me, that giving chicken to a little bird seemed almost cannibalistic. And, you know, giving him beef was sort of weird because there's no way this tiny little bird in the wild would be taking down and eating something the size of a cow. And then I had this kind of epiphany that if Chaplin shouldn't be eating these creatures because they were too close to him or he wouldn't be able to kill them, that maybe the same thing applied to me. If Chaplin was so close to the chicken that he couldn't eat the chicken, maybe Chaplin was so close to the chicken that I shouldn't be eating the chicken. So that sort of started a big, a lot of reflection, as, you know, 15-year-olds do as they start to encounter their own thoughts about the world. And so I decided at that moment to go vegetarian. And then in college, went vegan, was a philosophy major, and I had a course at the University of Texas in mind and body. And we were studying animal minds, and we read part of Peter Singer's Animal Liberation. And that really kind of gave me a philosophical grounding in what had been sort of intuitive to that point. And so from there, I really got interested in both the theory and practice of animal rights and decided to go to law school and make this my practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, people have very close bonds with their pets, right? Pets become part of the family. It's kind of like the Native American conception of, you know, nature as being part of the family, I guess. And they, of course, then get special rights within the family. But this is something much more abstract.
it seems to me. Animal rights is something, you know, that goes for all animals, presumably. We'll come and talk about that a little bit more. So it's more abstract, and I think in that sense it's somewhat more difficult to conceptualize. We both went to the University of Texas, and the same actual liberal arts degree program plan too, but I graduated about 35 years before you did in 1975, which was only a few years after Christopher Stone published Should Trees Have Standing. Can you say something about that book?
Yeah, so that was a really groundbreaking contribution to the legal concept of who should matter. Christopher Stone, he passed away in the last year or two, but he was a law professor at the University of Southern California. And in 1972, he published this groundbreaking law review article called Should Trees Have Standing? And standing is this legal idea about who matters before the law, who counts, whose injuries should be able to give rise to a lawsuit. And under traditional environmental and animal law, nature and animals don't have standing. Their injuries don't matter. They can't be plaintiffs who can file a lawsuit to protect their interests. Instead, what we have to do is find human beings who have legal standing, human beings who have been injured because, you know, maybe they like to recreate in an area that's going to be developed, or they like to, swim in a river that's being polluted, but the river itself or the natural area doesn't have legal standing. And Stone suggested quite persuasively in my mind that no, actually entities like ecosystems and non-human animals should have standing in their own right to protect their own interests through litigation.
Okay. Well, in terms of that notion of legal standing, a number of people have written about animals on trial for various offenses, including murder, during times past. And I found one account from the 19th century that reports the following. Among trials of individual animals for special acts of turpitude, one of the most amusing was that of a sow and her six young ones at Laverny in 1457 on a charge of their having murdered and partly eaten a child. Now, I mean, does being put on trial entail recognition of certain kinds of legal rights or standing for animals?
That's a really fascinating question and a very curious phenomenon. And this is, you know, basically in the Middle Ages, and mostly ecclesiastical courts, which were religious courts, where in continental Europe there were animals put on trial for their transgressions against humans, and some of them were kind of individual, as you mentioned, you know, a pig that kills someone being put on trial and I think usually convicted and then killed. But sometimes it also happened to like groups of animals. So there would be sort of, you know, flocks of rats. I don't know if flock is the right term for a group of rats, but, cicadas might be put on trial for destroying crops. And there's a really interesting kind of question of whether that conception of animals under the law might be in some ways more progressive than our current conception, which is that animals are property and things and don't have any legal personhood or legal subjectivity. I would say that those are, it's essentially a kind of what some people have called negative legal personhood, which means that they have the obligations, but not the rights. If we think about personhood as possibly being both having legal rights, but also having legal obligations, these sort of animal trials reflected animals as having obligations to humans, but no rights against humans. So that pig, for example, had no right not to be eaten. At that point in time, probably not even a right not to be treated cruelly or abused, but it did have a right not to hurt human beings. And so there is a sense that animals did have some intentionality that they could be held responsible for, but that was only used to, you know, hold them accountable. But it's really, it's a very interesting phenomenon, and it sort of faded out in the era of the Enlightenment and got replaced with the sort of Cartesian idea from René Descartes that animals were just automatons rather than sort of intentionally acting subjects.
But it seems to me that putting an animal or a group of animals on trial connotes intent, right? That there's some kind of consideration or sentience, and the animal decides it's going to do this, right? It's going to eat the child, or it's going to eat the grain. The group is going to eat the grain. And of course, in our modern system, people can be found incompetent to stand trial because they don't have the capacity to understand or reason. So, you know, where do you go with that kind of argument or notion that it attributes some degree of sentience and choice to animals?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's difficult to know kind of what the motivation was in of these medieval legal systems that were holding animal trials. I mean, some people say that they were really just trying to kind of impose a human order on a chaotic world, and that this was sort of a way of taking something that is rational and controllable, that is the human legal system, and imposing it on something that is uncontrollable, that is animals. But another way of looking at it is the one that you suggest, that there's sort of an idea that animals have a degree of intentionality, and maybe they would be deterred, for example, by knowing that that other pig down the street got prosecuted when it bit the kid, so maybe I should hold off from biting this kid. You know, I don't know that that's kind of the motivation or what the ecclesiastical jurist thought animals were thinking. I think it's probably more likely that they just sort of wanted to do this sort of performative idea of putting nature on trial as a way of imposing human control on the natural world. Like I said, in some ways it is a more progressive idea of animal legal personhood than what we have right now.
So what does the term rights actually mean then? We take it for granted, but we rarely sort of ask about the concept's history or function. And so where do rights come from? Where did they originate?
That's a really complicated question, and it really depends on...
That's why I asked.
Yeah, it's a good one. It depends on how one conceives of what a right is, and whether you mean where do they come from in the normative sense or where do they come from in the historical sense?
Historical.
Historically, we see this concept of individual rights arising probably initially in the Magna Carta in the 13th century in England, but we have these other kind of manifestations of declarations of individual rights in kind of Western jurisprudence in the 1700s and the 1800s. You have the, you know, in the 1700s, the Declaration of Independence and the US Constitution, the French Rights of Man, which is obviously gendered and maybe not accidentally so. So this idea does kind of arise in a particular historical social context to sort of describe an idea of, frankly, white male property owning humans and the dominion and despotism they have over the rest of the world, human and non-human. And obviously that suggests a pretty problematic way of framing rights. There's another way of looking at it though, that rights are simply the legal protections that individuals have against each other and the government. And in some ways that can be used for progressive ends. And you know, we can talk about you know, the claiming of rights by marginalized and oppressed individuals as a way of kind of fighting back against power and oppression. So there's kind of different ways of looking at rights and different ways of conceiving of rights. One distinction that I would want to make is that between legal rights and moral rights.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, when we're talking about moral rights, we're thinking normatively about what should be the case. And so we would sort of think about kind of from a position of moral philosophy or ethical philosophy, what is a person or a group or a community entitled to as the kinds of beings that they are? That would be kind of the moral question. The legal question is maybe more descriptive, where we say, what is it that the law provides? What rights does it give to an individual or a collective? And those are quite distinct from moral rights. There could be moral rights without legal rights. Frankly, we saw that recently with the overturning of Roe versus Wade, that many of us believe that there is a moral right for pregnant people to control their destiny, to control their bodies, to make decisions about their future. But as of Friday morning, that's no longer a legal right in the fundamental sense protected by the US Constitution. So thinking about the distinction between moral and legal rights, I think is important, both in the context of animal rights, but also more broadly.
I would say that the decision, the Supreme Court's decision, though, illustrates political struggles over rights. They can give, they can take away. And that then is about power. But liberal societies like ours are then premised on private property, right? And this, in some sense, rights then become ownership of the bodies, individual ownership of the body. As you were talking, I was thinking about the enclosure of the commons as an example in which tenants and villains went from being the property of the lord to being autonomous individuals, right? And then migrating to the cities because they no longer had work, they'd lost their land, right? And then being granted certain rights and responsibilities as a means of control. It wasn't just simply they're now free individuals, they're free individuals who we have to control. And the consequences of that are seen in the English Civil War, right? When groups like the Levellers demanded full rights of autonomy and social rights as well. I'm lecturing. I don't want to do that too much. But that whole sort of connection is kind of interesting. But to go back to this issue, abolition of slavery was based on the proposition that no human being should own the body and labor of another human being. And John Locke then refined that to say that one's labor is one's own property, except if it's a servant who you're paying, and then the servant's labor is the property of the person who's paying for the work, of course. Right, but then rights then seem to come out of this notion of property in the body. And isn't that a tricky and problematic basis on which to infer a whole range of both human rights and then animal rights?
Yes, I mean, I think it's certainly, the history of the origin of rights and their linkage with the ownership of private property, as I mentioned, it kind of arises in an era of colonialism and expansion, and before that, feudalism, where that conception of rights as stemming from the sort of strictly autonomous, self-controlling individual is sort of descriptively problematic, right? None of us are truly autonomous. We're all dependent on, the help of others, both for recognition of ourselves and also through, just the ability to exist in society. And so I think sort of founding rights on an idea of individual ownership of the body and labor is sort of descriptively maybe incomplete. But I don't think that's the only way of framing rights. I mean, as a former litigator, I guess still a litigator, I think of it a bit more pragmatically, as rights are simply the protections that have been, in the legal sense, legal rights, are the enshrinement of protected moral rights for the sake of the individual. And so to say, for example, that a non-human animal has a right not to be treated cruelly is just to say there is a statute that says it's illegal to treat an animal in a way that is cruel. And most of those statutes were passed with a recognition that animals count morally, not necessarily that they have full equality with human beings, but these are protections passed for the sake of the animals themselves. And that, I think, qualifies as a legal right. So the way that I think about it is a legal right is simply a protection for the sake of the other that creates a duty on someone else. And so because the legal system has in some ways, certainly incompletely and insufficiently, but created protections for animals that impose duties upon human beings, the duty to not abuse animals, the duty to offer appropriate food, sufficient water, adequate shelter, that those are at least a form of legal rights for animals that is not necessarily beholden to this sort of kind of idea of rights that has the problematic history that you're describing.
But you know, rights were also justified under the notion of natural law, I think, weren't they? You know, natural law, invoking that is to make it inviolate, right? It's to make a right inviolate because it's a transcendent source. You can't appeal. It's just there. The historical perspective, which obviously I prefer, is interested in how these changes, how these ideas and changes were rationalized, who they served. And the in the case of rights, you mentioned obligations and duties. Doesn't there have to be a human being to recognize a right of another or the right of an animal? I mean, animals are not going to say we have rights, at least as far as, not yet, until communication improves. So it's a kind of a duty imposed or an obligation imposed on human beings, which means that it's mostly, well, it's kind of shaky, it seems to me. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is sort of a, you know, the recognition would have to be through the human legal system, right? So there's always going to be sort of a human mediation between the rights of animals and the legal system. And it may be, you know, I'm a bit agnostic on this question of whether there is such a thing as rights in the absence of sort of positive law. So there's this debate between natural law and positivism, which is, you know, are there these transcendent things called rights that's inhering deep in my bosom, or is it just sort of this materialist thing that we have convinced the government to recognize or convinced each other through social structures to recognize? And, you know, a lot of people a lot smarter than me have spent their careers trying to sort through that. And I sort of throw up my hands and say, you know, I don't know. I think there's a utility to saying there is such a thing as natural rights, but, you know, it's not a material property that one could identify. So it gets tricky. I would say at the very least, rights could be a social construct that we recognize through social systems and legal systems. And if we can use those structures, which are inherently mediated through human beings, if we can use those to alleviate animal suffering, to recognize the capacity of animals to flourish, to protect their, what I think is their inherent dignity, then that's a good thing to do.
I didn't want to give you the impression that I believe in natural law. But it's interesting, just to get back to the Supreme Court decision, that they did not invoke natural law. They invoked historical precedent, right? Which again, it seems to me is problematic, right? I mean, they could have said the fetus, as is argued, right? The fetus has this natural law right not to be killed. But they didn't do that, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, history then acquires a sort of transcendent quality, right? You attribute to history the cause of this decision. And, you know, that can't be changed. I mean, it's a sort of an interesting contradiction, it seems to me.
Yeah. And of course, history is as subject to interpretation as our interpretations of natural law or inherent rights, as we saw the day before the Dobbs case with the New York gun control case, which was, you know, justified by sort of originalism in history, but the scholars of the Second Amendment and the idea of gun regulation you know, being a forbidden thing in the context of an individual right to bear arms, I think has been pretty clearly manufactured by the Federalist Society and others to reach a particular political endpoint. So, you know, a lot of this stuff is incredibly malleable.
Yeah, well, I mean, that gets back to the idea, perhaps cynical idea, that the law, positive law, is simply the means by which the powerful control the weak, right? I mean, but I'm not attributing that to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think in many cases it is, but it's all because that is one of the battlegrounds of sort of this cultural war, that it is one that should be engaged by progressives and animal folks as well. I mean, in some ways it is a rigged game, but in other ways there are ways to make gains. I mean, we had 50 years of protection of the right to an abortion because of agitation and litigation that enshrine that as a right. Now, as we're seeing, that's not permanent. These sort of culture wars continue to rage even after the right has been supposedly established. But for 50 years, it was protection that many people benefited from in material ways.
Some people are not to get completely off topic, but I know some people are comparing this to the Brown versus Board of Education case, in which the denial of a particular right, which had become deeply entrenched, right, was overturned. And I mean, it caused a lot of political uproar for, you know, years and years afterwards. And I think also of Dred Scott, right, as being these kinds of major decisions. It's just that we didn't expect it in our lifetime, I suppose. Yeah. Right. And grew up with the idea that rights are inviolate, and once recognized can't be changed. It's an object lesson. Let's go on to a different and more cheerful topic. Tell us some more about Happy and the elephants in the Fresno Zoo and the horse.
Yeah, so, you know, as I mentioned, there is extensive litigation, really trying to recognize, you know, kind of the idea that Christopher Stone suggested 50 years ago, interestingly, the year before Roe was decided, that there should be legal personhood beyond the human, beyond just individuals or corporations, that recognizes kind of the inherent value of the non-human world. And so I've been involved in a couple of cases that, you know, much of my career was in animal protection litigation. So cases that were trying to enforce protections for animals through statutes like the Humane Methods of Slaughter Act or the Endangered Species Act, the Animal Welfare Act, state anti-cruelty laws. And that's sort of what some people call animal protection law or animal welfare law. There's another area which is maybe under the umbrella of animal protection law, but quite distinct, which is animal rights law, which is trying to establish legal personhood and legal rights for animals. And a couple of those cases are the ones that you mentioned, brought by the Non-Human Rights Project, to seek a writ of habeas corpus on behalf of animals that the Non-Human Rights Project argues are unjustly confined. So they brought a series of cases in New York, first on behalf of chimpanzees, then on behalf of elephants. They've also done cases in Connecticut and recently filed a case in California against the Fresno Zoo, all trying to get courts to recognize the legal personhood of at least some animals based on their capacity for autonomy and the principle of equality. So if the law says we ought to treat like cases alike, and if animals have some of the same capacities and capabilities as human beings, including the capacity for autonomy, to make decisions that govern their own lives. Although again, we come back to Dobbs about whether that's truly a concept that the legal system recognizes for all human beings. It doesn't, but if we at least recognize that principle in some cases, maybe that ought to be extended to animals as well. So the Happy case is one on behalf of an elephant named Happy who was kidnapped from Thailand in 1972. It's interesting how that year keeps coming up. How serendipitous. But she was taken from the wild, brought to the United States, put on display at a safari park along with a number of other elephants. They all had names of the seven dwarves, which is how she became Happy. But it is a misnomer. She was brought to the Bronx Zoo in the mid 70s and then has been there ever since. And for the last several years, she's been by herself, which is torture for elephants. They're incredibly social, matriarchal animals, and to confine them by themselves causes pretty severe psychological distress.
We might mention that her companion died a few years ago, right? She had a companion in the enclosure.
That's right.
But this case doesn't relate to that at all, I suppose. I mean, this petition.
Yeah, so it's just in regards to Happy. There is one other elephant at the Bronx Zoo, just to be clear, an elephant named Patty, but they don't get along, so they're housed separately. So it's bad for both Happy and for Patty. But the Non-Human Rights Project filed for a writ of habeas corpus to have Happy transferred from the Bronx Zoo to a sanctuary that would better take care of her and meet her needs. The New York Court of Appeals, which is the highest court in the state, just ruled about a week ago against Happy and found that she was not a legal person and could not be granted a writ of habeas corpus. So unfortunately, that case has met the same fate as the prior cases on behalf of chimpanzees, the case in Connecticut on behalf of elephants. So unfortunately, the courts have not been ready to recognize legal personhood for animals, but there have been a couple of dissents that have given one hope that at least some judges are starting to recognize the claim for legal personhood for non-humans.
Have the rights of animals been recognized anywhere in the world? I mean, these kinds of rights?
Yes. So there is a case out of Argentina on behalf of a chimpanzee. And then there's a orangutan case and then a bear case out of Colombia, I believe, mm-hmm. That have recognized habeas corpus rights for animals. So interestingly, countries in Latin America have been much more receptive to the idea of animal legal personhood. Cases out of India have recognized legal rights for animals. And there's a case out of Pakistan that recognized legal rights for an elephant named Kaban. So these arguments haven't gotten a lot of traction in US courts, save for a couple of dissents. But in other jurisdictions, they are meeting with more success, which one could speculate as to the reason. Some have suggested that it has to do with the extent to which Western legal systems are kind of beholden to an anthropocentrism that may be less deeply woven into other legal systems, or it may just be the circumstances of the individual judges. But it's interesting to note where there's been success and where there hasn't.
Do these countries follow the Napoleonic Code?
So Argentina is a civil law country. Mm-hmm. The others, India is a common law country. So there's a split between civil law and common law. But it kind of both, there have been victories in
both. Yeah. Okay. Well, do all living beings have rights then? Mosquitoes, ticks, and so on.
It's a difficult question. So, if we're talking about legal rights, the answer is an unequivocal no. There's, to my knowledge, no country in the world that gives legal protections to mosquitoes or ticks outside of sort of if they were endangered, maybe there would be prohibitions on killing them. But do they have moral rights is an interesting question. For me, I think about these, about the basis for moral rights being whether or not an individual has interests, and that stems from whether or not they're sentient. So as far as I'm concerned, any individual being that has the capacity for pleasure and pain has an interest in not feeling that pleasure and pain, and that gives rise to a right to consider that pleasure and pain. This is, an idea that derives from kind of a utilitarian idea of what counts and what matters. So I would say, to the extent, I don't know what the science is on the sentience of mosquitoes and ticks. But I will also say, even if those animals, I will say those animals are morally considerable. I also think there's some value to the precautionary principle, which is the idea that we ought to tread carefully, especially in areas where we don't know very much. And I think given our limited knowledge about animal consciousness, animal suffering, animal pain, their ability to experience the world, there's this idea of the umwelt of each individual animal, the kind of clearing of their existence. And if that is the case for these animals, we ought to consider them. Does that mean you can't kill mosquitoes to prevent malaria? No. I don't think rights are absolute. Even human rights are not absolute. And so sort of thinking about what the trade-offs are in any given case is going to present problems and challenges and sort of how we move forward and make policy choices. But I do think we ought to ethically consider the interests of everyone involved in our decisions, both at the level of individual creatures and at the level of species, and even at the level of ecosystems and natural entities.
You use the term umwelt. Mm-hmm. Can you explain that just briefly?
Yeah, so that is an idea that comes out of a sort of early 20th century biologist named Jakob von, I can never pronounce his last name right, but it's having a bit of a renaissance. There's this new book by a guy named Ed Yong, who's a science journalist for The Atlantic. He has a new book out called An Immense World, where he uses this concept of the umwelt, which is kind of the experiential life world of each individual animal, kind of the from the perspective of that individual animal, what does the world look like? So my house, for example, looks very different to the human beings who live in it compared to the dog who lives in it, right? The dog is much more, her construction of what our house and our space looks like is going to be driven by the smells, the sounds, much more than by what things look like. The colors are going to be very different from her perspective than from the perspective of my son, or my daughter, or my wife. And so each individual has their own umwelt, their own kind of clearing of the world, and that experience is going to be different depending on species and depending on sort of one's own kind of personal history and biography. And so to sort of create a ranking of, this animal is more important than that animal, chimps are more important than pigs because they can recognize themselves in a mirror, is kind of a, a fool's errand, in my opinion. Like, different animals have different capacities based on their evolutionary history. And to sort of create a hierarchy is going to be a challenge. Now, if you ask me, is it better to kill a mosquito or a chimpanzee? I'm going to go with killing the mosquito. But it's difficult to, there's a lot of philosophical, ethical issues that to sort through that I don't really have the answers to. And some of it is more intuitive and some of it's more rational.
You mentioned that this notion treats animals as individuals and not just as species, right? Mm-hmm. And so individualism rears its head in this particular area, right? Which in some ways may be itself part of the problem. There are religions, Jainism and some variations on Buddhism, which refrain from killing anything, right? On the principle of possible reincarnation, right? You never know. Mm-hmm. We're sort of getting into that particular area with this kind of, individualist regard or individual regard. I don't know if it's a problem, but that then suggests that you can differentiate between, animals and a species.
Yeah. Personally, I don't have a commitment to that metaphysics of reincarnation.
I'm not suggesting it. I'm just raising it.
Yeah. I do think that, each individual that has an experience, we ought to consider what that experience is. Now, what we do with that is you know, questions of politics and you know, ecology, and there's a lot of other questions that are involved. I don't think that saying someone is morally considerable or that they, even if they have rights, forecloses or pre-answers the difficult political and ecological questions that we have to make in living our lives and avoiding, you know, climate collapse and everything else. So, you know, some people have treated rights as trumps, sort of the end of the question. Oh, if a mosquito has moral consideration, it has rights. If a mosquito has rights, you can't kill them. So, you know, let people die of malaria. You know, I think that's a pretty morally reprehensible approach to take. So I think we ought to be open to ethical and moral and legal claims, but I don't think that answers the hard questions that we will nevertheless have to address.
We're coming to the end of our interview, and in the last few minutes, I want to actually raise some arguments about the whole question of rights and I guess and regard. And that has to do with this notion of recognition. You've brought that up, but I read this article in the New York Review of Books about a German philosopher who's written about recognition, and you know, it's not something that's particularly new. But the idea here, not as they understand it, but as I think about it, is that we exist as individuals only by virtue of our relationships with others, right? And therefore, it's kind of like the elephant. We're incomplete. Indeed, we're not humans unless we have grown up in relationships with others, right? So there's a sense in which the individual is a product of the society, right? This is completely opposite the dictum, Thatcher's dictum, there is no such thing as society. You know, can we extend this notion to the world around us so that we're not, the world is part of us as individuals, right? And as a society. And then you don't get into the problem of trying to define rights. The is enough to justify the autonomy of animals.
Yeah, I mean, I think this idea of the individual situatedness within a larger community is important. And I think, you know, we see the same thing in animal communities as well. If you look at, you know, orcas, there's so much cultural transmission, or chimpanzees, there's a significant amount of cultural transmission of knowledge of learning how to be a chimpanzee or learning how to be an orca. It's not just sort of you're born with this biological programming and you do it. There is, you know, a sort of recognition of the self within the community or the troop or whatever it might be. And so I think that makes a lot of sense in the context of animals. I also think it's a good sort of rationale for recognizing animal personhood. There's a philosopher, Martha Nussbaum, who writes about animals' capacity for flourishing as the kinds of individual beings that they are. And that idea of flourishing within your own kind of capacities, to me, makes a lot more sense than the sort of linear individualist sort of ranking of animals based on who can recognize themselves in a mirror, or who can do math problems, or who can use sign language, or what have you. Instead, we ought to recognize the animalness of animals, mm-hmm. not the humanness of animals. That's mm-hmm. not the basis for legal rights. The basis is that they have the capacity to flourish as the kinds of critters that they are. And we ought to respect that and recognize it, to use the language of recognition, mm-hmm. In law, and say that infringing on the ability of the animal to flourish as an animal is an issue of justice, and one mm-hmm. that the legal system ought to be concerned about. And so recognizing animals as legal persons with legal rights may look individualistic, but I think is a way of creating the space in which animals can flourish both individually and within their own communities in a collective sense as well.
What was the story with the horse?
Yeah, so the horse, that's a case that I've been litigating for a number of years with the Animal Legal Defense Fund, where there's a horse named Justice who was a victim of animal cruelty. His owner left him out, this is in Oregon, left him out in the Oregon winter with no food, no water, no shelter from the elements. He lost a bunch of weight. He was 300 pounds underweight when he was rescued. He was emaciated, had frostbite on his genitals, real bad shape. And he was fortunately rescued and nursed back to health. But he has sort of lifelong veterinary injuries that will require some care, both physical and psychological. And so we filed a lawsuit with Justice as the plaintiff. Justice is suing his former owner for damages that would be put into a trust that could only be used for Justice's care and comfort. So he would essentially, it's a tort lawsuit. You know, if someone were the victim of a crime, an assault, say, they could sue the person in addition to that person being criminally prosecuted if they were. There's a separate civil action where one could recover financial damages that would then be used to sort of right the cosmic wrong of the injury, but also tangibly give them resources to counteract the harm that they've suffered, to pay their medical bills. And so we filed a lawsuit on Justice's behalf, essentially a negligence action against the former owner, arguing that she should have to pay for his medical bills and put money into a trust to care for him into the future. The case was dismissed for lack of standing and on the argument that an animal can't be a legal person that can initiate litigation. It's currently pending before the Oregon Court of Appeals. We expect a decision relatively soon, but also anticipate that it could go up to the Oregon Supreme Court for further consideration and litigation.
Well, in our last couple of minutes, maybe you can tell us what you're working on right now.
Yeah, so my scholarly work right now is focusing on two issues. The first is kind of the issue we were talking about before, which is the utility of litigation for social movements, whether or not suing to establish precedent or to contest oppression is a valid and effective movement, effective tool for social movements seeking liberation. And I use a case study from the animal law movement to argue essentially that litigation is an important tool in the toolbox, that it is by no means a pathway in and of itself to liberation, but that it can be used situationally and critically to further the goals of social movements and to liberate individuals. So I look at a case study that shut down a roadside zoo and led to a bunch of animals going to sanctuary to show how litigation can have tangible effects for social movements. And then the other piece that I'm working on right now is on animal plaintiffs. So it's really addressing all these questions of whether or not animals can be plaintiffs. Do they have rights? Are they legal persons? And what are the kind of practical and political considerations of recognizing them as participants in litigation?
Well, Professor Liebman, I want to thank you so much for being on Sustainability Now. It was a fascinating discussion.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Ronnie.
And we'll keep track of what you're up to. So until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
Big and friendly.
Elephant.
Wrinkled and gray.
Elephant.
And with her great big feet, better get out of the way of the elephant.
Elephant.
Every sound in the jungle the elephant hears, with their floppy king-sized elephant ears. Got a trunk or a nose as long as a horse.